We've come to the final lecture in our course on the history of the United States Supreme Court. It's time to look back on that history and also to look forward, to use the perspective of the past in viewing the ongoing role of the court as an institution in American government. It's impossible, of course, to predict with any degree of certainty what the future holds for any institution in society. But I think we can apply the basic themes of this course to give us some idea of the role the court will play in shaping American law as it decides cases that reflect the changing nature of our society in the 21st century. I'd like to restate the themes that we discussed in our first lecture and that we followed throughout the course. One of those themes is that of continuity and change. On one level, of course, both American society and the Supreme Court have exhibited great continuity over the past two centuries. Ever since the American Revolution freed the original 13 colonies from British rule and the United States became an independent nation, our system of government has endured with little fundamental change. We have lived under the Constitution that was drafted in 1787 during a hot summer in Philadelphia for a longer period than any other country in the world. But the continuity of our government and the Constitution is itself based on change in society at large. Many of those changes have profoundly affected the lives of all Americans. Over the past two centuries, the nation has increased dramatically in population, from 4 million residents in the first census of 1790 to more than 280 million in the census of 2000. There have been profound economic changes as well, as the country moved from a nation of small farmers to an industrial power, fueled by advances in transportation and technology. Now, these profound changes in American society have been accompanied by the twin factors of consensus and conflict, the second major theme of this course. We've benefited, in my view, from a shared consensus on the principles and values of representative democracy and the rule of law. The old saying that we are a nation of laws and not of men is more than a truism. Our commitment to democratic government and the rule of law have spared the American people from rule by demagogues and dictators, while the Bill of Rights has protected those who dissent from the tyranny of the majority. But this basic consensus has endured through periods of great conflict in American society. The political struggles over slavery, the military battles of the Civil War, and more recent conflicts over issues like segregation all stem from the greatest conflict in American history, the conflict over race. We've also experienced bitter and sometimes violent conflicts over issues like religion and abortion. These different sources of conflict reflect a third theme in this course, the theme of diversity. The American people are amazingly diverse in areas such as race and ethnicity, religious belief and disbelief, political ideology, family structure, and sexual orientation. We are not a homogeneous nation in any sense, unlike those in which the vast majority of the population shares a common race, religion, or political outlook. But neither are we a nation so divided in these areas that we face continual outbreaks of racial, religious, or political violence. As we know, American history is full of such outbreaks, but they've generally been short-lived and contained by law enforcement. Now, we've revisited these themes from our introductory lecture to place in focus the Supreme Court and its landmark rulings over the past two centuries. I'd like to briefly review the court's origins and its later development in the context of the three periods in its history that we outlined in the first lecture. The first period begins with the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and extended through the First World War. This period spanned more than a century, marked by conflicts over slavery and the national trauma of the Civil War. The second period extended from the 1920s through the court's leadership by Chief Justice Earl Warren. The most significant events of that period, and the ones that most dramatically affected the court, were the Great Depression of the 1930s, World War II, and the court's ruling in 1954 that public school segregation violated the Constitution. The third period overlapped those years and was marked by the court's rulings in such different areas as religion, criminal law, political protest, and abortion. During the last three decades of this period, the court was led by two conservative chief justices, Warren Burger and William Rehnquist. Of course, these three periods in the court's history are not neatly divided and distinct, but they provide us with very different approaches to the ways in which successive generations of Supreme Court justices have interpreted the Constitution and have shaped judicial doctrines that affect the outcome of the landmark cases we've discussed in this course. It's important, I think, to look back on the court's landmark decisions during these three periods in history in the context of some of the more philosophical and broad questions that affected its rulings. And it's also important to consider these questions in terms of the judicial doctrines that emerged from the court's reading of the Constitution. These doctrines are developed and employed by justices as tools for deciding cases. But they reflect different approaches to judicial decision-making, approaches that are rooted, I think, in the political views and judicial philosophies of the justices. And, of course, there are competing doctrines that are often employed in the same case, with justices in the majority expressing one doctrine and those in the minority another. As we've seen in these lectures, a judicial doctrine that is dominant in one period of the court's history is later rejected or revised in another. And the factors that influence these changes in doctrine reflect both the court's membership and the broader social and political changes outside the court. We've seen that changes in the court's membership through death and retirement can very quickly and dramatically produce changes in prevailing judicial doctrines. Perhaps the best example of this was the Constitutional Revolution in 1937 and the addition of several liberal justices by President Franklin Roosevelt. The second factor that has a great impact on the rise and fall of competing judicial doctrines stems from broader changes in American society. One example of this factor was the gradual but rapidly accelerating shift in the American economic system during the 19th century. The agrarian economy, based on small farms and small towns, gave way to an industrial economy of factories and mines and mills. The rapid development of railroads, the production of steel and machine tools, and the mass production system of turning out huge quantities of consumer goods required millions of workers, many of them recent immigrants. And these basic economic changes produced conflicts between workers and employers and conflicts between farmers and the railroads that shipped their goods to markets. We've seen in several lectures how these conflicts brought cases to the Supreme Court and how the judicial doctrine of liberty of contract became dominant on a conservative court. Another example of the great impact of social and political change stemmed from the growing demands of black Americans for racial equality during the 20th century. We've seen how the civil rights movement, through groups like the NAACP, launched a campaign against Jim Crow laws and school segregation, a campaign that spanned almost 50 years between the founding of the NAACP in 1909 and the landmark Brown decision in 1954. This campaign would not have succeeded in the court without pressure outside the court, as blacks and sympathetic whites began demanding an end to legalized segregation. And the judicial doctrines the court employed in Brown and other civil rights cases, especially the strict scrutiny doctrine and an expansive reading of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, reflected the liberal views of the justices who joined the court between 1937 and 1953. What these two examples of doctrinal change illustrate, in my view, is the linkage between the justices and the world outside their chamber. Who sits on the court and the views they bring to the bench is largely determined by who sits in the White House. We've had conservative presidents like William Howard Taft, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan who named conservative justices. And we've had liberal presidents like Franklin D. Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson, who placed liberal justices on the court. And there have been middle-of-the-road presidents, like Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, to name a Democrat and a Republican. Most of their Supreme Court nominees took middle-of-the-road positions on the bench. Now, we've also seen that not all justices turn out the way that presidents expected them to. Justice Felix Frankfurter came to the court with a liberal reputation and became a judicial conservative on many issues. On the other side, Justice Harry Blackmun had a conservative voting record during his early years on the court and gradually moved to the liberal side. Supreme Court justices, of course, are people whose views can, and sometimes do, change over time. Exposure to new issues and the exchange of ideas within a small group like the court can change the outlook of a justice. Some adopt a narrower reading of the Constitution and others a broader reading. My point is, and I think many of our lectures have illustrated this point, that the outcome of many landmark cases reflects the complex interaction of personality and politics. Let me give two examples to make this point concrete. One is the Dred Scott decision in 1857, ruling that no black person could be a citizen of the United States. The opinion of Chief Justice Roger Taney said that blacks have no rights which the white man is bound to respect. Taney also ruled that Congress had no power to ban slavery in the vast territories that stretched from the Mississippi River to the Pacific Ocean. I doubt whether Taney's opinion would have been so dogmatic and uncompromising if he were not a dogmatic and uncompromising defender of slavery with a background in Southern politics. My second example is the court's unanimous decision in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, ruling that school segregation violated the Constitution. Chief Justice Earl Warren based his opinion on the feeling of inferiority the segregation produced in the hearts and minds of black children. I doubt whether Warren's opinion would have been so expansive in its reading of the Constitution and so understanding of the impact of segregation if he had not witnessed that impact on people like his own chauffeur, who was barred from sleeping in the same hotel that welcomed Warren during a visit to Civil War battlefields in Virginia. Now, as I've said, the interaction between personality and politics and its expression in judicial doctrine is a complex matter. Chief Justice Taney was not just a mirror of the system of slavery in which he grew up and developed his views of blacks. As we saw, other members of his class, both lawyers and politicians, abhorred slavery and fought against it with equally uncompromising determination as Taney defended it. And other members of Chief Justice Warren's class, both lawyers and politicians, defended segregation with as much determination as he opposed it. But each of these chief justices led a court with a majority of like-minded men who joined the opinions of forceful and determined leaders. And those like-minded justices had been placed on the court by presidents whose elections reflected the views of a majority of the American people. Of course, most voters don't cast their ballots for presidential candidates with any thought of their future Supreme Court nominations. But the outcome of presidential elections reflects the prevailing currents of public opinion, sometimes conservative, sometimes liberal, and sometimes in the middle. And those shifting currents are affected, in my view, by deeper forces of social and economic change. So the impact of these complex factors on the outcome of particular Supreme Court decisions is often difficult to predict, if not impossible. Now, with this background of the links between judicial doctrine, personality, and politics, I'd like to briefly discuss another issue that has run through this course. This is the conflict between judicial activism and judicial restraint. As we saw in our introductory lecture, this conflict in approaches to deciding cases has often been linked, at least in the public's mind, with liberal and conservative positions on the issues that come before the court. Many people associate judicial activism with liberal political views. Judicial activists in this view are those who are willing to override the judgments of elected officials who represent the majority of the voters who elect them to office. On the other side, those who follow the position of judicial restraint are more likely to show deference to elected lawmakers and are reluctant to strike down laws that reflect majority sentiment. But if we look back at the cases we've discussed throughout this course, the link between liberal activism and conservative restraint is more apparent than real. Just about half of the cases we've discussed resulted in judicial reversal of state or federal laws or of executive and administrative policies. And the Supreme Court upheld those laws and policies in the other half of the cases. Let me offer a few examples. The first, and perhaps the most important, came in the landmark decision of Chief Justice John Marshall in the case of Marbury versus Madison in 1803. In this case, Marshall struck down an act of Congress that had conferred jurisdiction on the court to issue what were called writs of mandamus. Marshall said that Congress could not add to the court's original jurisdiction, which is spelled out in Article 3 of the Constitution. Now, we can view this as an example of judicial activism. But Marshall was not a political liberal by any means. He was a staunch Federalist, the party that supported the business interests of that time. I think it's more accurate to view Marshall's decision in the Marbury case in the context of his firm belief in judicial supremacy over the other branches of government, in carrying out the court's duty to say what the law is, as Marshall wrote in his opinion. In a sense, the Marbury decision represented conservative activism. The court exerted its power to decide what the Constitution means. It was clear to Marshall that the Constitution did not give Congress the power to expand the court's jurisdiction without a constitutional amendment. Several other examples come from the court's rulings during the period from the 1880s through the early years of the 1930s. During this entire period, the court was dominated by judicial conservatives who employed the doctrine of liberty of contract to strike down many state and federal laws. The court ruled in the Lochner case in 1905 that New York did not have the power to set maximum working hours for bakers. The state law in this case had been passed by a majority of New York's lawmakers. The court also struck down in 1923 a federal law that authorized a commission in the District of Columbia to establish minimum wages for women in the case of Children's Hospital versus Adkins. In both of these cases, the court displaced the judgment of elected lawmakers, asserting its power to examine the substance of laws. There have been many other examples on the other side of this question. During the later years of the Great Depression of the 1930s, the court upheld a state law that set minimum wages for women in the case of West Coast Hotel versus Parrish. The court also upheld a federal law that protected the right of workers to join unions and bargain with their employers over wages and hours. Is it accurate to call these cases examples of judicial restraint? Or is it more accurate to say that a different group of justices, more liberal than their predecessors, read the Constitution differently? As Chief Justice Hughes said in the West Coast Hotel case, the Constitution does not speak of freedom of contract. It speaks of liberty. And to Hughes and the four justices who joined his opinion, the Due Process Clause did not prohibit elected lawmakers from carrying out the will of the voters on issues like minimum wages. As Hughes put it, regulation which is reasonable and is adopted in the interests of the community is due process. In my view, the issue is not judicial activism versus judicial restraint. In most cases, the deciding factor in the court's decision is the prevailing political balance on the bench. When justices are confronted with laws that conflict with their political and economic views, they will most often vote to strike them down. When the laws agree with their views, they will generally vote to uphold them. This is where judicial doctrines such as liberty of contract and strict scrutiny come into play. In my view, such doctrines, however honestly they reflect the justices' reading of the Constitution, are rooted in the political and economic views of the justices who adopt and employ them. Now, this may seem a simplistic or even cynical perspective on the difficult task of determining the meaning of such broad constitutional phrases as due process or equal protection. or the meaning of terms such as commerce or contract. But I think Chief Justice Hughes made a perceptive comment when he said, before he joined the court, that the Constitution is what the judges say it is. That is, the meaning of constitutional provisions depends on who is on the court at any given time. Now, there's another perspective on this issue that deserves some discussion as we conclude this course. Over the past few decades, many influential legal scholars and several justices have advocated the position known as original intent. That is, justices should look for the intent of the framers in reading the Constitution and deciding cases. The most forceful advocate of this position in recent years has been Justice Antonin Scalia, who is known as a judicial conservative. Scalia has argued that the meaning of the Constitution's provisions was determined by those who framed them, and the justices have no warrant for reading their own views into the Constitution. Conservative politicians, including Presidents Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, used the term strict constructionists in describing the kinds of justices they wanted to place on the court, a term that describes those who advocate the original intent position. There's certainly a strong argument for following the intent of the framers, at least when that intent was clearly stated at the time a constitutional provision was adopted. But in my view, efforts to find the clear intent of those who frame such provisions as the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment or the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment are not likely to provide much guidance in deciding particular cases. For example, did the framers of the Due Process Clause intend that welfare officials must conduct hearings before they cut off benefits? This was the question in the case of Goldberg versus Kelly, which the court decided in 1970. Justice William Brennan, a firm judicial liberal, wrote in his opinion in this case that welfare recipients were entitled to a hearing and to be represented by a lawyer in welfare termination cases. He later said his opinion was based on what he called the underlying vision of human dignity enshrined in the Due Process Clause. But it's difficult to find the origin of this decision in the intent of those who framed the Due Process Clause. Another expansive view of the Due Process Clause was expressed by a judicial conservative, the second Justice John Marshall Harlan. Writing in 1961, Harlan said, "Due process has not been reduced to any formula. Its content cannot be determined by reference to any code. It represents," Harlan added, "the balance which our nation, built upon postulates of respect for the liberty of the individual, has struck between that liberty and the demands of organized society." But that delicate balance has shifted many times over the past two centuries, as both American society and the Supreme Court have adapted to the changes we've discussed in this course. Now, before we conclude this course, I'd like to say a few words about my selection of cases and topics for these lectures. We've discussed some 120 of the court's landmark decisions over the past two centuries, ranging from 1793 to 2003. But over the course of its entire history, the court has decided more than 30,000 cases. During the 19th century, the court often decided several hundred cases each year, many of them in brief opinions, and most with little enduring significance. It would be impossible, of course, to discuss more than a small fraction of these cases in a course of this length. But I've tried to include cases that illustrate some of the drama and emotion that can make the Supreme Court chamber almost a theater. The tearful arguments of Daniel Webster in the Dartmouth College case and of John W. Davis in the school segregation case from South Carolina. The emotion of Justice Thurgood Marshall's argument in the Little Rock case, and the outrage in Chief Justice Warren's voice in the same case, denouncing the defiance of Arkansas officials to the court's ruling, are examples of how the court can become, in fact, a very dramatic chamber. I hope you'll agree that the cases we've discussed in this course will spur us to look more closely at its past decisions through the books I've suggested for further reading, and to follow the court's future decisions with some greater understanding of its crucial role in American society and government. There's a final point I'd like to make before we conclude this lecture and this course. The Supreme Court is an institution with a structure and functions that were established in the Constitution more than two centuries ago. But the court is still a small group of people who make their decisions around a conference table through a process of discussion and debate on cases that often have a momentous impact on American society. It's the people, much more than the process, that have been the focus of this course. During our lectures, we've met several dozen of those people, many of whom left a lasting imprint on the court and on American society. Those who stand out and who have completed their service include John Marshall, Roger Taney, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Felix Frankfurter, Hugo Black, Earl Warren, William Brennan, and Thurgood Marshall. And it bears reminding that the court decides cases that began with the lawsuits of real people, many of them ordinary people with extraordinary courage. People like Dred Scott, Homer Plessy, Lillian Gobitis, Fred Korematsu, Mary Beth Tinker, and Michael Hardwick. Like the justices, these people differ greatly in background and values, but they all place their cases in the hands of people who shared a responsibility that is chiseled into the court's marble facade, equal justice under law. To what extent this promise became a reality in the cases we've discussed certainly depends on our own views and values. But we all share a responsibility as members of the American community to think about the meaning of that promise, not only for ourselves, but for future generations of Americans. That brings me to my own thoughts about the court's future. I have no crystal ball and no idea of how the court might change with the certainty but also the uncertainty of death or retirement at any time. I do feel confident that the court and the Constitution will endure for many years to come. But it will certainly change as justices depart and their successors arrive. Most likely, the kinds of cases and the issues they raise will also change as American society and the world outside our borders also changes. The great diversity of this nation, one of the basic themes of this course, guarantees that conflicts over values and interests will bring many new issues before the court. I'm also convinced that other nations will adopt the model set by our Supreme Court of an independent body with the power to protect the rights of all persons to the values that are embodied not only in our Constitution, but in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This document, which was adopted by the United Nations in 1948, recognizes the inherent dignity and inalienable rights of all members of the human family and incorporates the provisions of our own Bill of Rights, including the right to life, liberty, and security of person, and to the equal protection of the law. These are laudable goals for any nation, but in a world that is torn by wars between nations and within them, by the growing inequality of rich and poor, and by deeply rooted conflicts over race, religion, and ideology, those goals have yet to be achieved for most of the world's people, and even for many in our own country. I want to end this course with a personal note. I have very much enjoyed preparing and delivering this course for you. Even after three decades of study, teaching, and writing about the Supreme Court, I continue to learn, and I continue to view the court with respect, despite my frequent disagreement with its decisions. Most of all, I continue to feel both excitement and awe when I visit the court and listen to the arguments in its chamber. I hope I've passed on that excitement and awe to you. Thank you for sharing this learning experience with me. And I think it's appropriate to end this course with the words that began our first lecture in the chamber of the United States Supreme Court.
The Honorable the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of the United States are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.